This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new movie adaptation of Last Exit to Brooklyn, the 1964 novel by my guest Hubert Selby Jr. Last Exit is a collection of stories about hoodlums, hookers, drug addicts, and transvestites. The characters are brutal. Their stories are hopeless. Selby said he was trying to portray the horrors of a loveless world. Although the novel is now considered an urban classic, it was shocking and controversial when it was published. Time magazine called it Grove Press's extra special dirty book for fall. Last Exit was the subject of a major obscenity trial in England. It was banned in Italy. In America, an editor was arrested for having published one of Selby's stories. Hubert Selby has written other novels, but his first remains the one he's best known for. The movie is directed by German filmmaker Uli Edel. Selby was a consultant and stayed on location for the shooting. I spoke with Selby in May when the film had its U.S. premiere.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The African National Congress announced today that it has suspended its 29-year armed struggle against white minority rule in South Africa. The announcement came after a second round of talks between President F.W. de Klerk and ANC leader Nelson Mandela. When he went into the talks, Mandela said he was looking for agreement on such issues as the release of political prisoners and the return of political exiles. Iraqi soldiers rounded up more than 300 foreigners from three hotels in Kuwait today. 28 American citizens were in the group. The Iraqi ambassador in Washington was summoned to the State Department for this message: Iraq is being held responsible for their safety. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The new batch of Americans picked up by Iraqi troops were staying in three hotels, along with British tourists and other foreigners stranded after the Iraqi invasion. A U.S. State Department spokesman didn't rule out the possibility that the group may show up in Baghdad, the Iraqi capital. However, a warning issued by the Iraqi-installed government in Kuwait against foreigners whose governments have imposed sanctions was worrying to U.S. officials. The matter of the 28 Americans was raised when the Iraqi ambassador was called to the State Department. The safety of Americans was discussed in a meeting today in Baghdad when the U.S. ambassador there was summoned to see the Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Over the weekend, Iraq released 11 oil workers who had been picked up by Iraqi troops on the first day of the invasion. In Dubai, this is Deborah Amos.
British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher said today that if United Nations sanctions against Iraq prove ineffective, Britain is prepared to consider joining with its allies in a naval blockade of the Persian Gulf. Thatcher expressed confidence, though, in the comprehensive ban on trade with Iraq and Kuwait that was approved today by the UN Security Council. The Prime Minister spoke after meeting with President Bush. Numerous West German firms have helped Iraq build weapons factories, according to a West German magazine. Deirdre Berger reports.
The weekly news magazine Der Spiegel says more than 100 West German firms were involved in the construction of a cannon factory north of Baghdad that was completed this week. A nearby munitions factory, already in operation, was also reputedly built with West German business know-how. The magazine says other firms have helped Iraq with nuclear research, as well as with the production of missiles and chemical weapons. West German authorities have been investigating for years reports of illegal shipments of technology and know-how by West German firms to Iraq, but no charges have yet been filed. Earlier this summer, a West German businessman was sentenced to 5 years in prison for his company's role helping Libya build a chemical gas factory. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The Dow Industrials posted their seventh biggest loss in history today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just over 93 points to close at 2716.34. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new movie adaptation of Last Exit to Brooklyn, the 1964 novel by my guest Hubert Selby Jr. Last Exit is a collection of stories about hoodlums, hookers, drug addicts, and transvestites. The characters are brutal. Their stories are hopeless. Selby said he was trying to portray the horrors of a loveless world. Although the novel is now considered an urban classic, it was shocking and controversial when it was published. Time magazine called it Grove Press's extra special dirty book for fall. Last Exit was the subject of a major obscenity trial in England. It was banned in Italy. In America, an editor was arrested for having published one of Selby's stories. Hubert Selby has written other novels, but his first remains the one he's best known for. The movie is directed by German filmmaker Uli Edel. Selby was a consultant and stayed on location for the shooting. I spoke with Selby in May when the film had its U.S. premiere. The movie continues to open in more and more cities around the country. The stories in Last Exit are set in the slums around Brooklyn's waterfront, where Selby hung out in 1949.
Well, it was at the time as the New York port of embarkation. They used to call it the Brooklyn Army Base. And it subsequently has been closed, and it's now being turned into office space. But that operated all through the Second War and the Korean War. And tons of troops and material and equipment was shipped from the Army base overseas to Europe. And, of course, there was a lot of Navy personnel there as well. And it was like any neighborhood waterfront area. There's a lot of violence, just an incredible amount of violence.
Were you ever beaten up when you were living in that area?
I never lived in that area.
You're just hanging out there.
Yeah, just hanging out. And was I ever beaten up there? No, I don't think I was.
I figure you were probably fairly weak at the time because you had TB when you were a little bit younger. And as a result of the TB and some surgery that they performed on you in an attempt to cure the TB, you were probably in a weakened state. And I was wondering if that left you in a position in which you were easily picked on, if it left you in a position where you felt likely to be victimized.
No, I was in a weakened state. I mean, I had 10 ribs cut out, and there was nothing left but an oil slick. And I was actually in between hospital stays when I was down there. But I don't think I've ever been picked on in my entire life, to tell you the truth. I may have felt like I was. I think every kid does in school or so forth. But I don't know that I've ever been picked on before or after the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But I had no problem when I was hanging out down there. As a matter of fact, I think what happened and what had happened in other areas after the surgery was that people tend to take care of me more. They look out for me. So rather than pick on me, they kind of protect me.
The film was shot on location.
Correct.
How had the neighborhood that Last Exit to Brooklyn is shot in changed from the time that you wrote it?
Well, we didn't shoot it in the neighborhood where the book takes place. That neighborhood was unavailable. And the other neighborhoods, I don't know how much they've changed because I've never been there before. Mm-hmm. But I suspect that, like most neighborhoods around there, the big change was ethnic, where many years ago, when I wrote the book, it was basically an Anglo-Saxon Italian neighborhood. It now was a lot of black, West Indian, Puerto Rican neighborhoods. But basically still, I think, the same.
The film is directed by a German director. Is there anything that he wanted to know from you about that period in American life, or that period in your life, or in Brooklyn?
Everything.
Uh-huh.
We went from Los Angeles to New York in December of 1986. It was Uli, the director, Barrett, the producer, and Barrett's associate, Herman. And we drove around the old neighborhood, I guess all day Sunday. We went there on Saturday and Sunday, and then we came back. And I rode to New York with Uli, so that gave us maybe 6 hours on the plane, 5 or 6 hours on the plane, talking constantly about the book, about the neighborhood, about the people. We talked a lot about the music and the source material, and then the same kind of conversation over the entire weekend while in New York. And he just obviously needed and wanted to know everything possible about the entire environment and the area and the era in which this takes place.
I think one of the best-known characters from your novel is Georgette, who you describe as a hip queer. He's a homosexual, but often dresses in drag and is described as a she in the book. Who is the character based on?
Well, there was a young guy named Georgie that lived in the neighborhood, and I didn't understand my relationship to Georgie at the time, but I realized subsequently that I had a very deep and profound affection and compassion for Georgie. And in a very real way, Georgie was responsible for my writing the book. And that came about to anticipate a question. I wrote the first part of a section of Last Exit called The Queen is Dead. I wrote the first part of that story, and I called it Love's Labor's Lost, and that was published in the Black Mountain Review. And a year or two later, I met someone from the neighborhood, and they said Georgie had been found dead in the streets, literally in the gutter, and evidently died of an OD. And as I said, I didn't understand the emotions behind this at the time, but I knew I had to finish the story. I could not allow Georgie to have died, especially such a humiliating death, without doing something for him. I had to give him I had to dignify his life in some way. And I mean dignify, not romanticize. And so I finished his story, and as I was doing that, the concept for the book developed. So in a very real way, Georgie was responsible for my writing Last Exit to Brooklyn. And when they suggested I play the role of the car driver in the movie that hits Georgette and kills her, it just seemed absolutely perfect for me because, and it seemed poetic too, that I would be, in a sense, killing Georgie when I brought Georgie to life in the book and then subsequently on the screen, and that finally, hopefully, Georgie can be put to rest and find the dignity that all life deserves.
Did any readers assume that you were either gay or a transvestite after reading either the story, The Queen is Dead, or Last Exit to Brooklyn?
As I understand it, most people assumed I was gay. And also, a friend of mine told me a very interesting story. He was talking with a black friend of his, and he said that this friend of his assumed I was black because I had depicted black people so well. So I guess I'm a black, gay, homosexual queen or something.
I had heard from someone that your publishers wanted you to pose with your wife just so readers would know he's not a homosexual.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten about that. I think somebody interviewed me and suggested that we do that, have a picture in whatever magazine that was. And if I remember correctly, I said, no, that gay people buy books. Let's not scare them off. I'd forgotten that. That's true.
So they went for that, huh?
Well, whatever. I mean, I don't know, but they went for it or not.
There's no redemption in the book in the sense that, you know, people don't see the light and change their ways and so on. In fact, some of the most interesting people are the ones who get killed. But each chapter of Last Exit to Brooklyn starts with a quote from the Bible.
The Old Testament.
Were you religious at the time you wrote it?
Not in the sense of organized formal religion, no.
But in another sense?
I think of it more in a spiritual sense, not a religious sense.
Mm-hmm. And Christian?
Hmm?
Are you a Christian?
Oh, am I a Christian?
Yeah.
As far as I know, no.
Okay.
I have no intention of being one.
And has that sense, that spiritual sense, but outside of organized religion, increased or decreased as the years have gone on?
Well, I don't think it can increase because I think we're nothing but spiritual beings, but my awareness of it and my conscious contact with it has increased.
Mm-hmm. Hubert Selby Jr. is my guest, and I want to ask you, now that I'm reintroducing you by name, your nickname is Cubby.
Correct.
How did you get the name?
Well, I'm not sure, but when you have a name like Hubert, and you're... And you're playing on the streets of Brooklyn with Vinny and Mikey and Tony, and they look at you and say, Hubert, Hubert. You know, you have to do something to survive. And at one point when I was maybe 10 years old, in that area, someplace, I was on a team called the Bear Cubs. And the only connection I can see between the nickname Cubby and some event in my life is that. So maybe from that came the name Cubby. I don't know, but I am eternally grateful And maybe the only reason I survived my childhood was eventually I got to be called Cubby instead of Hubert.
Okay, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Hubert Selby Jr., and his first novel, Last Exit to Brooklyn, has just been made into a movie. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Hubert Selby Jr., and his novel Last Exit to Brooklyn has just been made into a film. How did you start to write? You dropped out of high school.
Well, I don't know if I went to high school.
Oh, really?
Well, I did finish the ninth grade. I guess that's high school.
In my neighborhood, it was junior high.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, I left at 15. I started to write because I was taken off a ship in Germany when I was 18. They said I couldn't live more than 2 months. And I've been given up for dead many times. And I just didn't want to waste my life. I had what I now realize was a spiritual experience. And what happened was I knew that someday I would die. And just before I died, two things would happen. Number one, I would regret my entire life. And number two, I would want to live my life over again, and then I would die. And that terrified me. As I say, it was a spiritual experience. And, you know, as you know, those experiences are far more profound than any experience we can have at this level of consciousness. And to think that I would live my entire life, look at it, and say, oh, I blew it, was such a terrifying thought that I bought a typewriter. I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I bought a typewriter because I had no ideas or anything else. But that is what got me to start writing, was I did not want to waste my life. I wanted to, and I had to do something with my life.
Well, writers like Richard Price have credited you with giving them the sense that the stories in their neighborhood, that the language that they and their friends used could be the language of literature. What gave you the idea that your stories and the kind of street language that you used or that people around you used could be the stuff of literature?
Well, when I started to write, I knew I had to write about something I knew, that I couldn't just invent a whole new thing like science fiction or whatever. I knew that wasn't my area, my shtick. And I was just guided and directed from, again, this inner source, this creator of life, whatever it is that exists within all of us. And I certainly didn't define it as such at the time, but everything else was put out of my mind, and my mind only focused on certain things. And so every night for the next 6 years, I came home from work, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. Some nights I'd get one word, some nights two words. But every night for 6 years, I worked on this book, and that was the only thing that was given to me to write, was those experiences.
What kind of job did you have at that time?
Oh, most of those years, I worked in an insurance agency. I calculated and administered pension plans and group insurance plans.
Were you any good at it?
Very, very good.
What kind of family did you come from? Were they poor, middle class?
Middle class. I was born just before the Depression, and I had nothing to do with that. Believe me, it wasn't my fault. So I don't know what kind of middle class there was from 29 to 39, but whatever it was, that's where we were.
So you dropped out of school when you were 15 and you mm-hmm. went to work on the waterfront. Why did you drop out?
I was as restless, irritable, and discontent. I couldn't stand it. I just couldn't stand it. And I also knew I could never succeed in school. It terrified me. I knew I didn't have whatever it takes to go to school. And in many ways, that's true, I didn't. I couldn't do it. I had to go. I had to go.
So you went and you worked on the waterfront. What was the experience like for you, and were you exposed to the kind of violence and corruption that you've written about?
Not really. I wasn't. It was a job. You know, I worked on tugboats. I worked on on launches. I worked on dredges, and then I went to sea on Liberty ships. And no, I wasn't exposed to it in that sense. And I loved it. I've always wanted to go to sea. If I hadn't gotten sick, I might still be going to sea. I just loved it. I loved everything about the water.
Well, when you were 18, you signed on to a freighter, and that's when you got tuberculosis, right?
Well, actually, I had been sailing on freighters for a couple of years at that point.
I see.
I started, I guess I was 15 or 16 the first time I sailed to Europe, and it was just after my 18th birthday when I was taken off the ship in Germany.
With tuberculosis?
Correct.
Now, if I have this straight, the therapy that they used for you, because you were very sick, was... The doctors deflated one lung, took out part of your other lung,
mm-hmm.
and then removed 10 ribs. Why did they remove 10 ribs?
Well, they cut 8 ribs out on one side to collapse that lung permanently. And they cut a couple of ribs out on the other side to cut the piece out of the lung. And they had used an experimental drug to keep me alive. And that impaired my vision and my hearing, and my inner ear was almost totally destroyed, and I couldn't walk. I'd fall down and all my muscles were petrified from the drug, so it was kind of a mess.
Was this all experimental therapy at the time?
No. The surgery and everything was not experimental. It was, one of the few ways they had of dealing with a situation as advanced as mine.
So you've been permanently weakened, I guess, by the experience, but lucky that you survived.
Yeah, I'm a survivor. I'm tenacious. I've had 4 different doctors in the last couple of years say to me that 2 doctors in Germany and 3 doctors here in this country have said to me that according to all accepted medical evidence, I'm a dead man.
Huh. You got hooked on morphine from the hospitalization experience after the TB and the surgery?
Mm-hmm.
Were there any medical precautions that were taken, so that you wouldn't get hooked?
Well, you can't prevent it, but, I didn't leave the hospital physically addicted. I just fell in love with the stuff when I got it in the hospital and eventually found it on the streets.
How did you kick?
Oh, it was really very simple. I got arrested, and they strapped me down in solitary, and I kicked my habit.
So you kicked in prison?
Not prison, just a jail, county jail.
Still must have been pretty excruciating.
Well, it was very unpleasant.
Was anybody kind to you while you were there?
Yeah, nobody was unkind. Yeah, the system, of course, is a drag, but there was nobody was nasty to me or anything. And again, I just kind of have a way of finding the biggest, strongest murderer and becoming friends with him, and nobody bothers me.
Really? Is that the trick?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what's the technique?
I'm not sure. It's just some inner thing of survival that allows me to kind of smile the right smile and talk the right talk. I have a way of knowing what goes on inside of people, and I can appeal to that.
Is this something that you've done not only in prison but outside of prison, to kind of get the right protection?
Oh, well, not consciously always to get the protection, but to talk with people with their language about their life, yes.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that makes people comfortable, and they respond. They respond to you.
How did the publication of Last Exit to Brooklyn change your life?
Well, I guess the big thing, at least from my point of view, is that some money started to come in, and I could just dedicate my life to drinking and other aspects of chemical warfare. And I finally drank myself to death, and I found another way to live.
Excuse me, you found another way?
Another way to live. I finally drank as much as I could, and I couldn't drink anymore, and I ended up getting sober, and I just entered another phase of living.
How have you made a living in the past 25 years in addition to your books? You've also had jobs.
Oh, many jobs. I've worked in gift shops and gas stations and offices. A couple of years ago, I was on welfare. I was a single parent and had been sick for a few years. I couldn't work, so I was on welfare for a year. So I just, whatever I need to stay alive.
When you were working in gift shops or gas stations, would you often get recognized by people who knew your writing and wondered what you were doing there?
Not in this country. No. Never.
Did you often wonder what you were doing there? Did you wonder why you had to be doing this?
Oh, absolutely. I wondered. As Riley used to say, what a revolting development this is. I don't know how I end up where I end up. It's remarkable.
Some bio of you says that you had written for the National Enquirer for a time. Is that right?
Well, I was working there. I didn't exactly write. They had a mail order thing for a while. And a friend of mine was the head of that, and he gave me a job kind of writing copy for, mail order, like underwear and stuff, that kind of. So.
Do you remember any of your copy?
Oh, ladies, this trico underwear. I don't know. You know what I mean? I don't know. Things like that. I had that a few weeks, however long.
Well, in the past few years, one of the things you've done is tour with people like Henry Rollins of Black Flag, the hardcore group, and you perform with Lydia Lunch,
right,
who's a punk singer. What kind of affinity did you feel with them and they with you? I mean, they're a lot younger. They were part of punk rock.
Well, they sought me out, actually, and they had been reading my work. And I remember it was amazing, talking with Henry about it. He had read all the books and really understood them. And I just instantly liked the guy, for one thing. I met him a couple of years ago for the first time. He's an extremely bright, sharp young guy. And he has a huge heart. He also has a little confusion like the rest of us. And we hit it off very well. And so we did a few gigs in L.A. And then last March, we did a tour of Europe together. And it was terrific. I get to meet a whole new world of people that I never met before. Because most of the people that come to see Henry, and they're like under 30, those people. A lot of them in their teens. So I meet people that I would never have met except under those circumstances.
You've been teaching lately, right?
Yeah, except I don't really call it teaching. I have a fiction workshop in the graduate school at USC. And I go down there one night a week.
Mm-hmm. So when was the last time that you were either on welfare or working at a kind of job that you really didn't feel you belonged in, like, the gift shops and the gas stations?
Oh, a couple of years ago.
That recently?
Yeah. When I was working for a job that ended, I guess, in the end of 86 or 87. Yeah, the end of 87. So I guess since then I've just been home working, writing. Yeah.
You writing something now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And Hubert Selby Jr. is the author of Last Exit to Brooklyn, and he was an advisor and has a cameo in the new movie version of the book, which just opened. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And let me ask you, should I have been calling you Cubby? I mean, do you still not like the name Hubert?
Oh, no, now it's home. Now I like it.
Now you like it.
Yeah, but 50 years later.
Okay, well, thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, music from New Orleans. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has an appreciation of clarinetist George Lewis and a review of a new 5-album retrospective of Lewis's work. Also, a talk about writing with Scott Spencer, the author of Endless Love and the new novel Secret Anniversaries. And a review of a new novel from Polish writer Tadeusz Konwicki. Book critic John Leonard says it's a mix of Gone with the Wind, Turn of the Screw, and Russian politics. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The African National Congress announced today that it's suspending its nearly 30-year-old guerrilla war against minority white rule in South Africa. The suspension is to take place immediately. The announcement followed 16 hours of talks between South African President F.W. de Klerk and ANC Deputy President Nelson Mandela. The delegation said they also agreed to draw up plans for release of prisoners connected to the ANC. Also, amnesty will be granted to some of the 20,000 South African exiles who want to return home. The agreement is seen as a major step toward the beginning of formal constitutional negotiations to end apartheid and give the country's black majority a voice in national affairs. The United Nations has imposed sweeping economic sanctions against Iraq. Linda Fasulo of member station WNYC reports from New York.
With big power unanimity and by a vote of 13-0 with two abstentions, the Security Council moved decisively to impose a worldwide economic, military, and financial boycott of Iraq and occupied Kuwait. Only Cuba and Yemen, the Council's sole Arab member, abstained. Emerging from the Council chamber, U.S. Ambassador Thomas Pickering said the countries of the world now have a test as to whether or how they will rapidly implement this resolution. The far-reaching measure also directs nations not to recognize the new Kuwaiti government installed by Iraq and to protect the assets of the legitimate Kuwaiti government. The decision requires Turkey and Saudi Arabia to shut down the pipelines that transport Iraqi oil through their countries to the outside world. UN diplomats note that with this action, the Council has again asserted itself as a significant actor on the international stage. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo reporting at the United Nations.
As it seeks ways to increase the pressure on Iraq, the Bush administration is moving on several diplomatic fronts in addition to the United Nations. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
U.S. diplomacy in the Gulf crisis has 4 goals, officials say: to get Iraqi forces out of Kuwait, to restore a legitimate government there, to ensure the free flow of oil from the Gulf, and to protect Americans in the region. U.S. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney met today with the rulers of Saudi Arabia to discuss the invasion of Kuwait and its implications for Saudi security. Few details emerged from the meeting, but it's assumed that Secretary Cheney is offering assurances of U.S. protection in the event that Iraqi forces push into Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, Secretary of State James Baker is to fly to Turkey later this week to confer on the crisis. 90% of Iraqi oil exports flow through pipelines in Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and both countries are coming under increasing international pressure to turn off the tap as a way of enforcing UN sanctions against Iraq. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The U.S. State Department says an American is among the foreigners taken hostage today by rebel forces in Liberia. Rebels led by Prince Johnson took 14 or 15 people from the Africa Hotel in downtown Monrovia. Stock prices closed significantly lower today.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, a talk with novelist Scott Spencer. But first, New Orleans clarinetist George Lewis was 41 years old and working as a stevedore when he made his first recording as a sideman with trumpeter Bunk Johnson. The year was 1942. By the time Lewis died, a little over a quarter of a century later, he'd played all over the world and recorded dozens of records. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new Lewis reissue set.
If you know even a little bit about jazz, you've probably heard the story that the music was born in New Orleans and then steamed up the Mississippi River to Chicago with Louis Armstrong and company around 1920. Of course, no real story is ever so simple. In fact, most early New Orleans jazz musicians never left home, and the music scene there remained healthy until the Depression. But New Orleans has never been a center for the recording industry, and few of those stay-at-homes cut records before the 1940s. One musician who began recording then and went on to make lots of records was clarinetist George Lewis. Lewis is the subject of a new box set of 5 LPs or 3 CDs from Mosaic Records. The complete Blue Note recordings of George Lewis brings together 6 sessions recorded in 1943 and in the mid-50s. As usual with Mosaic, it's nicely packaged and annotated, contains some previously unreleased takes, and is available only by mail. I'll give you their address in a little while. Unlike most Mosaics, this one has uneven sound quality, because the 1943 sessions were recorded on primitive equipment. But their informal nature is really an asset. They let you hear some New Orleans jazz uninfluenced by audience expectations. Musicians like Lewis saw themselves as entertainers, not artists. In performance, they'd give audiences what they thought they wanted to hear. The most fascinating music comes from a low-fidelity rehearsal session. In New Orleans jazz, the clarinet usually weaves around the trumpet. But there was no trumpet at the rehearsal, so Lewis's clarinet takes the lead. In the 1940s, fans and writers hailed players like Lewis as conservators of the unspoiled, original, real jazz, as opposed to newfangled stuff like swing and bebop. But New Orleans jazz had been evolving all along, like any musical style, and its players had been listening to records like everybody else. On that same session, Lewis plays an adaptation of Hula Lu, a big hit from the Hawaiian music craze of a few years earlier. You don't have to care about the historical implications of George Lewis's music to appreciate how powerful it is. His playing is both deeply spiritual and technically assured. Lewis never learned to read music, and a conservatory professor had to tell him that some of the stuff he played was probably impossible. His swooping melodies owed a lot to the piccolo players he heard in New Orleans brass bands. That's the Gettysburg March, recorded in 1955. By then, Lewis was the key figure in the New Orleans revival movement. His band was touring a lot, and their music had become tinged with crowd-pleasing hokum. But Lewis's clarinet work lost none of its passion or drive. This sort of music sounds dated to some people, but for me, George Lewis's playing has a timeless grace that transcends the settings he appeared in. This unassuming man was one of jazz's true masters, and this new mail-order box set contains some great Lewis recordings. So let me give you the address of Mosaic Records. They're at 35 Melrose Place, Stamford, Connecticut, 06902. I bet a lot of jazz fans have that address memorized by now, because Mosaic has made a habit of reissuing worthy but hard-to-find music, just like this.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. The complete Blue Note George Lewis is available by mail from Mosaic Records in Stamford, Connecticut. This is Fresh Air. Scott Spencer's 1979 novel, Endless Love, was both a bestseller and a critical success. Franco Zeffirelli's film adaptation couldn't give you a sense of Spencer's dizzying writing about an obsessive teenage romance. Although Spencer isn't responsible for that screenplay, he's written several others and is working with Paul Schrader on a remake of Laura. Readers often wonder how autobiographical Spencer's novels are, but his new novel, Secret Anniversaries, is about things that he couldn't possibly have experienced firsthand. It's set a few years before he was born, when America was divided about entering World War II. It's about a woman who falls in love with another woman, an aide to a congressman suspected of collaborating with the Nazis. This is the first time the two women touch.
Betty moved closer, waited. She seemed to be testing to see if Caitlin would move away. They both understood the first gestures would all have within them an element of the accidental, that they would have to be able to say, oh, sorry, or excuse me, at any point, and then withdraw, and that the fiction that they were only friends could then be preserved.
I like the paragraph a lot, because I think this is something everybody has experienced, you know, the sense of... I like the way you wrote it.
Thanks. Yeah, well, I experienced that the first time as I was out at a movie with a girl, the way you pretend like it's actually comfortable for your arm and shoulder to fling it around the seat that, oh, my goodness, you happen to be sitting in that seat, too. And it gives her the right, if she wants to move rather closer to your hand and maybe brush your hair against it. And that way you both have the protection of a manufactured accident.
You know, in most of your novels, there are these really wild, very passionate, very self-conscious love scenes. And I think I'm really interested in the self-consciousness and in sometimes the clumsiness.
Mm.
I think more than most writers I've read, you have a sense of the clumsiness that's so often involved in lovemaking.
Yes, well, I think if it really is lovemaking and not just some sort of display of sexual proficiency, it's necessarily clumsy because it's a meeting of souls, and it's a revealing of parts of character and personality and longing that remain otherwise hidden.
Is this your first novel that you've written in the third person?
Yes, it is.
Instead of first person?
It is.
You had tried to write in third person before, though, hadn't you?
It's true. It's always been something that I think I've tried to write all of my books in the third person. And I don't know why. Now that I've done it, I don't know what the big deal is.
Well, what is the big deal? What are some of the different things that you have to do in terms of finding the voice and in terms of moving characters in and out of rooms? Is it different in third person than it is in first person?
Moving characters in and out of rooms is not any more difficult. In fact, it's probably rather more easy in the third person since... you don't have to leave with them the way you do in the first person.
right, that's a good point.
finding a voice, I think, is trickier, maybe because it's hard to be living in 1990 and believe in omniscience of any sort. And so, you know, as you know, I do have a kind of secret narrator in this book that it's not an omniscient narrator. It is finally one of the characters who steps forward and lets us know that it's been he telling the story all along. And that was important for me because the kind of all-knowing and finally bland, authorial third person is uninteresting to me and doesn't really go along with what I'm interested in stylistically.
The first-person voices that you've used in some of your earlier novels have been very passionate, obsessive voices, and there's a sense of confession in the way the story unfolds. Is that something that you can't have in third person, that obsessive confessional quality?
Well, that's true. It would be difficult to have that in a third person, and it's probably one of the reasons why I wanted to write in the third person, because after having an obsessional confessional voice for a couple of novels running, I was sort of obsessed and confessed out.
Oh, uh-huh.
And was interested in enlarging my scope.
In some ways, are you trying to work within a certain genre form in the new novel?
Well, I'm interested and always have been interested in using the ingredients of so-called popular fiction, unbridled passion, ghostly visitations, and this one, World War II, and politics, and seeing them through the more scrupulous lens of art. I've been dismayed for as long as I can remember that so many of the good stories seem to have been abandoned to people who aren't necessarily good storytellers, whereas the most talented writers seem to be off writing a great deal about things that don't matter a great deal, things that are more matters of sensibility than of any pressing concern.
I have to ask you, most of the characters' names in your book are names that I think of as only being names that characters in certain kinds of novels have. Fulton Fleming, Caitlin Van Fleet, Sumner Wells, Elias Stowe.
Well, Sumner Wells is a real person.
Okay. We'll eliminate that one.
Well, let's eliminate that one.
That leaves us with Fulton Fleming.
That leaves us with a Fleming and a Van Fleet and a Stowe. And what would those certain novels be? You mean more pulpy pop novels?
Yeah, I guess pop historicals.
Well, you know, I don't really know.
Do you read them?
No, because I read too slowly to read bad books. It's a big investment for me to read a book. And I think that I write assuming the same about my reader, that I'm asking him or her to spend quite a bit of time with me, because I can't read a book in a night or even in three nights. It takes me quite a while to get through a book. So I've never been able to sort of knock off those historical romance books the way I suppose they were written to be knocked off.
Do you ever go back and reread your older books?
I but not sequentially.
You mean you don't read the books in order, or you don't read within the book?
I don't read within the book sequentially. I sort of jump around. And
what sends you back to one of your books?
Seeing them on the shelf. Being at someone's house who has one. Wondering if, you know, how I did something before. Nostalgia. Narcissism. A wish to hear my voice. Because I'm getting a little lost.
You mean in the new novel?
Right.
So when you feel like you're getting lost, it's easier to find your place if you read something that had a really sure voice.
A sure voice that reminded me that with enough work I can actually get this done. Because, you know, there's always these moments of terrible loss of confidence in the middle of a book. You're all alone in a strange place and you have no idea where you're going half the time.
What are the other ways of dealing with it?
Aside from drinking, you mean?
Oh, gosh, yes.
I don't know how to deal with it. Terry. You just have to keep some stillness within you that allows you to continue.
Do you become manic depressive when a book is out based on whether you get a good review or a bad review from critics who you respect? Or do you detach yourself from that altogether?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as manic depressive, but you know, it's hard not to react in some way, especially if you think you're being read in a foolish way. And it's hard not to feel that sometimes.
Not to feel that you're being read in a foolish way?
Right. I mean, it's sometimes a review is so beside the point and so misses what you're doing that you feel that you'd that yet another impediment has been put between you and the reader, and you wished it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. In your last two novels, there have been people who've lost someone they love through an act of basically political terrorism. If this is too personal, you don't have to answer it, but do you feel very close to that kind of experience, forgetting the political terrorism a second, but, you know, having lost someone you love?
I don't know why this is such a theme in my work, and it's been, in a way, in all of my books, because I'm very... Both my parents are still alive. I had no brothers and sisters to lose. Even my aunts and uncles are, for the most part, still with me. My kids are home and healthy. My wife's alive, and she's in good health. But yet this question of personal loss, of some inner devastation, pulls me toward it time and again, and I don't really know why. I know that I can't get away from it.
Is it, I feel like I'm such a cheap analyst here, but is it maybe the fear of losing somebody?
It could be the fear of something like that. Or it could be, I don't know. Of course, you know, if my next book, everybody's alive and happy and well, you'll know that I finally got that analysis we've been talking about.
Well, Scott Spencer, I thank you very much for talking with us.
It was good talking to you, Terry.
Scott Spencer's new novel, Secret Anniversaries, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what new developments do you have in the Kuwait story?
We're following decisions being made now at the United Nations and at the White House on how to respond to the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, and we'll be discussing the president's military options. We have some other stories. The African National Congress has renounced violence, at least for now. The American Bar Association is considering its position on abortion. And we're looking at the future of American farming, the prairie, and the possibility of sustainable agriculture, perhaps a prairie that could feed the world.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Polish writer Tadeusz Konwicki was born in the northeast of his country in 1926. It later became part of Lithuania. During the Nazi occupation, Konwicki fought in the Polish resistance and later fled to central Poland and settled in Warsaw. Konwicki draws on his family history in his new novel, Bowen Manor. Book critic John Leonard says the result is complex and rewarding.
Beneath the old-fashioned charm of Bowen Manor is another darker novel. It's a music box of a book, like the toy Swiss chalet the heroine plays with. Lift the roof and you hear a polonaise, a brassy farewell to the fatherland. But inside, besides melodies, there are also demons. The time is late in the 19th century, at the end of summer. The place is pastoral Lithuania. The heroine, Helena, a young woman of noble birth and impoverished circumstances, is about to marry into the local gentry. She falls dangerously in love instead with a red-haired stranger, about whom the police have their suspicions. Her father isn't much help. He hasn't said anything to anyone in years. Nor is the local priest, whose mind is on other matters. Even her faithful coachman, who claims to be 182 years old, is merely gnomic when Helena asks him for advice. There are wild doves, tame deer, a fearful storm, and gunshots. It's that sort of novel. On the other hand, it isn't really. In real life, Helena was the grandmother of Tadeusz Konwicki, the novelist we're reading. He is imagining her in fiction, as she decides on his future. By figuring out the novel, we figure out Konwicki. We need to know a little about 19th century history in the Baltics. Like Scarlett O'Hara, Helena belonged to a losing cause. She lost her plantation and her first love in a failed uprising of the Polish nobility against the Russian Tsar. In the woods, police are still hunting subversives. The red-haired stranger claims to be a revolutionary. And there's more. The red-haired stranger is Jewish. Jews haunt Helena the way ghosts haunt a governess in Henry James. Nor are these Jews the only ghosts. All over Lithuania, and in the grammar of Konwicki's imagination, there are also ghosts who live in a tense that can only be called the past, future, imperfect. For instance, the Russian police chief, with his mustache and his gray and horribly pockmarked face and his Georgian accent, can only be Stalin's father. And what are we to make of the wild beast in the forest who devours men and burns Jews? Its name is Schicklgruber, which was Adolf Hitler's family name. Pilsudski, the Polish warrior statesman, shows up as a little boy, and Lenin shows up as a baby. And if there's Stalin's father, there's also Pushkin's son. Not only because Pushkin wrote an anti-Polish propaganda poem, but also because the red-haired stranger wants Helena to call him Tadeusz, after the hero in the epic poem by the Polish Pushkin, Adam Mickiewicz, who also appears in this novel. And of course, Konwicki's own first name is Tadeusz. Is the past creating an appropriate future, or does the future always insist on an appropriate past? I haven't mentioned Tsar Alexander and Napoleon carving up Europe, nor the failed Paris Commune, nor the fairy tale opal from Australia, nor the odd weather that summer in Lithuania, with the fleecy sky and that strange, deep, all-embracing sound as if planets were grinding against each other, nor the way clocks are always striking, but nobody can ever remember the count of the chimes. Gone with the wind, and the turn of the screw, and revolutionary politics, and your own grandmother. What more, really, could any reader ask for?
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. We'd like to welcome the listeners of Vermont Public Radio's three stations, WVPR in Windsor, WVPS in Burlington, and WRVT in Rutland. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Mars. Science writer John Noble Wilford tells us about the next stop in man's exploration of space. And we meet character actor William Forsythe. That's him under the makeup, playing Flat Top in Dick Tracy. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air. From WHYY and